Hello, my fine friends. Welcome back to Destination Discourse. I'm your host, Stuart Butler, joined today with little old Adam Stoker. How are you, sir?
Little old Adam Stoker is doing fantastic. Thank you, Stuart. I appreciate it.
You're little and you're old and you're Adam Stoker. So it's technically it's correct.
You know, this is a clear sign of your privilege. When you're 6'3", everybody looks little. The old part, I'm not sure I understand entirely, but yeah, I'm a little jealous of the height. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I'm 6'2", but you know, I know relative to you, that feels like I'm a giant. So,
Yeah, it's like it's all a skyscraper when you're as short as I am. You know what I mean?
yeah, and the age, although chronologically, you're probably a few years below me. I think, you know, I felt like from a sharpness perspective, you know, I had COVID previously
Well,
last episode. I wasn't
experience,
quite as sharp,
knowledge,
you know.
wisdom, I could totally see why you feel like I'm a little old.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say. Not really. So Adam, I'm glad you're here today, but I'm more excited about our guest today because you and he have had some back and forth on LinkedIn. So I'm hoping we can have some spicy debate today. But we're joined today with Jim Harinchar. How are you, sir? It's nice
I'm
to
good,
have you on the
Stuart.
show.
And Adam, thank you. Good to be with you all.
It's
Good to see you, Jim. I'm worried we'll disappoint Stuart because he seems really excited for a big debate.
He's stoking the fires early, isn't he?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna say, hey Adam, he says something about your mom in a minute, like the one and only listener. We're gonna really get some
Tammy Stoker is a
feisty.
saint.
Yeah, that's not what Jim
Anybody know
says.
what movie that's from? No?
I don't. What is that from?
That's from Anchorman when Vince Vaughn yells, "Dorothy Mantooth is a saint." Anyway,
Okay.
that's my sense of humor. It comes mostly from the movie Anchorman. So,
before like 5, 10 years ago when it came out, you didn't have any kind of sense of humor. Is that what you're saying?
That came out 20 years ago, Stuart.
Are you
Can you believe
serious?
that?
Anchorman's 20 years old? Wow,
20
that
years
makes
ago.
me feel old. Dang, that does make me feel old.
Yeah.
I'm sure people didn't tune in to listen to the history of
Movie
Anchorman.
reviews.
Maybe they did. But you know one thing they did tune in to listen to, Adam?
Oh, I
And
do. I absolutely do.
that's the world famous jingle that we're hoping to play live in a couple of weeks at Esto, right? But it is time for the greatest segment in all of destination marketing. It's time for Stu's News.
What do you think, Jim?
Adam,
how do you like this jingle?
I'm taking it all in. Let's see.
So all you can really do is just sort of bear witness to it, you know, take it in. There's not much else to say. I got to tell you, I missed it for like the 3 weeks we didn't record, but now it's already old again. So
well, we recorded 2 days in a row, so I feel like it's a little bit justified. If you're hearing it every day, I could see that.
Yeah, well, I know you listen to it on your way into work every day. You know, it's your playlist on loop.
I fall asleep to it, Stuart.
Yeah, well, that checks. Yeah, that definitely checks out. But today's Stu's News is brought to us by, this is a source we have not used before, but it's from Vogue magazine. I'm sure, Adam, that you're very familiar with Vogue magazine. I would imagine
absolutely.
You're an avid reader and subscriber to that. But there was an article in there talking about the game of golf and how female participation is up like 40%. It's one of the fastest growing segments. And you know, talking about how now golf has become a lot more accessible, especially post-pandemic. You know, I think golf as a sport has been pretty much, there's been a barrier to entry for a lot of folks, right? There was a lot of formality to it in a lot of intimidation around golf. And I feel like COVID has really ushered away a lot of that. And they've sort of embraced this new wave. And it's not just female participation, it's also youth participation is up significantly. And then you also look at what's going on, you know, I kind of sort of bucket into two segments. There's on-course golf, your traditional golf, but then there's off-course golf. You've got things like Top Golf and Pop Stroke and even mini golf. And the participation in that has grown so much that off-course golf is actually bigger now, more participation in off-course golf than there is in on-course golf. But it's still an on-ramp, right? People are picking up a club for the first time to maybe do a Top Golf or a Pop Stroke. And then that's leading them to want to try the full game of golf. So the reason I bring this up, couple of things. One, Myrtle Beach obviously is the golf capital of the world. And by the way, the mini golf capital of the world. So golf is a big segment for us. And this is something we're sort of wrestling with is the changing dynamics. You know, it's shifting our strategies and how we reach golfers where they are, right? And who they are. But two, I think, you know, there's a lot around us that's changing societally in terms of who's participating in different activities. And I worry a little bit that the DMOs aren't necessarily on top of that sometimes. You know, we tend to see a lot of the same campaigns year after year going after the same audience segments with the same generic messaging. And golf is just one microcosm of it. But I just want to bring it to everyone's attention and to the conversation that, hey, we can't continue to do the same things every year because everything else is changing rapidly. And if we continue to do the same things, expect the same results, we're not going to get it, you know? So I don't know, Adam, you just had a chance to read this article. Any thoughts on it?
I feel like, first of all, you're essentially pandering to me on this one by choosing my favorite hobby and saying, yeah, let's talk about it.
Female golf is your favorite hobby?
Yeah, I guess you set me up for that one. Golf in general is my favorite hobby, male, female, whatever it is. But in all seriousness, golf is a fascinating thing because it's changed so much in the last 5 to 7 years. As someone who's been golfing for a long time, what happened during COVID was extremely disappointing to me as a golfer. Because I used to be able to just run up to the golf course and get out immediately, play a round of golf and 9 holes in an hour and a half. And it was different than it is today, where if I'm not 3 days ahead, I'm not getting a tee time. And so it's interesting because I would say the pie, as far as golfers in general, as you would define that term of golfers, that pie has expanded significantly. And I think what happened before COVID is golf in most destinations was kind of this built-in asset that was going to have its sliver of the pie, its percentage of the marketing budget that helped generate that sliver of the pie. And yet it's expanded so much that now there's a market share discussion to be had for destinations, especially like Myrtle Beach and other destinations around the country, who don't recognize that with the shift that's taken place, that pie is actually big enough to have a much larger impact on the destination than it would have before COVID, because so many more people have gotten into golf. And I agree with you. I think it's an untapped opportunity. I think the downside is if your golf courses are more booked now than they've ever been, there's the opportunity to open up a negative experience when somebody comes, they can't get a tee time, or it's difficult to finish around in a decent amount of time. So it's you need to make sure that your product is, if you're promoting golf, that you're promoting a product that's actually going to be a good experience for the user. And golf has expanded so much that I could also see an argument for not needing to advertise for it as much because there's already so many people playing golf and filling up the courses.
Yeah, interesting. Jim, are you a golfer?
I am, actually. Adam and I have hit on a big commonality here. I've actually been playing golf for 51 years, believe it or not. I'm not that old, but the numbers added up to 51. So I belong to a private club, have belonged to multiple private clubs over the years. We actually have a number of clients that are in the golf industry as well. And as you look at the numbers, you know, participation since 2019, the Vogue article alluded to some of this, but in general, golf overall is up 38% since 2019, but the female component is up 55% since 2019. And so if you look at 2024 Golf Foundation statistics, women made up 28% of golfers in 2024. The other fast growing segment is African Americans, minority population in general, but African Americans in particular made up 25% of the golf population in 2024. So, you know, anecdotally, I'll give you an example of a competitor of yours, Stuart. So I'm in Richmond, Virginia. In our, we'll call it our backyard, is Pinehurst. And so I was down there at the end of January Pinehurst used to have a season. This kind of alludes to Adam's point. Pinehurst used to have a kind of a winter season, and the rates were almost 50% lower than high season. And you could go down and you'd have the golf course to yourself at the end of January. And especially if, if the weather was, modest at best. I went down with a friend of mine this year, and we stayed at one of the Pinehurst resorts. And whereas our rounds of golf would be about 3 hours and 15 minutes in the past, every tee time was taken the end of January. The hotel we were in had 100% occupancy. Our round of golf was 4.5 hours, and we were miserable, to be quite honest, because nothing against the folks that were out there, but it was very obvious as you looked around at the participants. I love seeing all of the migration of different types of segments of our population playing the game, but a lot of them didn't grow up playing golf. So for them, golf may be an excuse for another opportunity to drink, and they're in no rush to play. And so a 4.5 round of golf for those of us that are avid golfers is an eternity. Not that we're trying to rush through a round, but it makes the experience not quite as enjoyable when you're out there waiting on every shot. In the bar after the round, where everybody kind of congregated, you could see there was a lot of new to the game golfers. They didn't have your traditional golf attire from one of the major brands with a collared shirt. You had folks that were in t-shirts, folks that were in sweaters with no, obviously no collars, folks that were playing in parachute pants, in tennis shoes, just representative of the dramatic changes in the game, which is great for the game of golf. Those of us, as Adam said, I'm a little disappointed and frustrated by what's happened is, yeah, my 3.5 hour rounds of golf are gone, and picking up the phone and saying, we're going to run down to Pinehurst for 3 days of golf. We can play 3 hour rounds of golf and we can do it cheap are long gone.
Yeah. Are you
Yeah,
guys,
can I?
as traditional golfers, are you playing more off course golf? Are you finding yourself with a club in your hand, not on the course, but maybe at a Topgolf or something similar, or virtual golf or anything like
Yeah,
that?
I would say Topgolf, not so much because the format of Topgolf, I think it is much more appealing to non-golfers than it is people who actually like to golf. But I'll say the simulator angle,
Yeah.
where that's an entire industry that's been created in the last 7 years or so, you'll find a lot of avid golfers on a simulator. Also, Top Stroke, I'll give you an example. I was with my wife in Phoenix over the weekend, and we were going to the Morgan Wallen concert. The idea of me bringing my golf clubs would have been a divorceable offense, right? But I suggested that we go together and play Pop Stroke, and we had just a fantastic time at Pop Stroke together. And yes, she got 3 holes in one and I only got one, but that's not really the point of the discussion, right? She had an incredible time, and so it allowed me, who really enjoys golf, to share golf in a way that she would enjoy, that isn't just going out on the course. And so that's a definitely something I'm seeing. The other thing that I wanted to touch on, Stuart, is I believe that there's an opportunity if golf has grown as much as it has in the last 5 years. I can tell you that availability of golf courses has not increased at the same rate that golf has, which means for destinations that may be looking for an opportunity to set themselves apart from other destinations or to increase visitation, golf, with the trajectory that it's on, may be the product development investment that could change the game for them. And you're seeing this in, like, in the middle of Nebraska, in the middle of nowhere, there's a massive golf resort that has popped up that has changed rural Nebraska's tourism generation. There's also in Oregon, there's a place called Bandon Dunes. It's a little more storied, a little more established, but again, all that's there is golf, and they're building new golf courses constantly because there's still demand. And so I would encourage destinations that might be struggling to find their place, struggling to find their differentiator. Golf may be a place where product development can really generate a pipeline of travelers for the next 25 to 30 years.
Yeah, and I agree. And not just with the traditional golf, right? But with all these derivatives as well, especially if you can bring it all together so people can have a full experience. Myrtle Beach obviously has a lot of golf courses, a lot of mini golf courses, Pop Stroke, Topgolf, virtual simulators. It's got kind of got the whole thing. But then they also add incentives here, like in the summertime, Most people don't realize this, but if you're a paying adult at most of our golf courses during the summer, kids can play free. And so what we're seeing is another shift, which is whereas the traditional family vacation used to happen, and then maybe the dads would come back with the buddies in the fall or the spring for the buddy trip, but they were separate trips. Now we're seeing them blend a little bit, where the dads and sometimes the wives and the kids will come and play a round of golf while they're on their family vacation too. So it's interesting. But again, I want, this isn't just about golf, right? This is about consumer behavior evolving and us as an industry staying on top of it so we can capitalize on it as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
Well, I think
cool.
there's
Well.
I think there's a fairly significant amount of innovation in the game. So if you look at some of the resorts, especially those that Adam mentioned, so Rodeo Dunes is the one that I think, well, that's in Colorado, but there's multiples in Nebraska. Bandon Dunes has this. Pinehurst has gone to this route. The Kaiser family is behind Sand Valley, which is in Wisconsin, which was, you drive up there and you think you're going to the edge of the earth. And then you realize there's five golf courses in the middle of nowhere that are just beautiful. But nine-hole golf has become way more popular than it used to be. It's not a traditional 18 holes. You're seeing more and more developers now building 12-hole golf courses. My wife doesn't play because she said if I had to spend 4 hours doing something, it wouldn't be playing golf. And so that's what drove her away from the game of golf. But 9 and 12 has a little bit more appeal to her, especially with the social aspect to it. And then having these short courses. That are a variety of 6 holes, 9 holes, 12 holes, all kinds of different configurations. So I think that overall is what's driving the growth of golf. And it's a great opportunity for folks to spend time outside. And the social aspect to it has become way more different. And I think that's what's allowed the various off golf course activities to proliferate. I couldn't believe that off course golf is up 55% since 2019. That's a big number. It's a big
More
number.
participants at on-course now. It's crazy. Well, I feel like I've done a good job of putting you guys on the same team for the first part of this episode, right? I found some common ground. You guys have been friends, singing Kumbaya around the campfire. But now I want to shift a little bit and maybe poke where there may be differences in opinions. But Jim, I'm going to hand it to you to start with. You're one of the folks that reached out to us when we'd asked on LinkedIn if anyone wanted to join the show or had a pet peeve that in the industry that or frustration that they wanted to come and have a chat about. So I'm just going to hand the mic to you for a second and tell us what prompted you to reach out and what that maybe that pet peeve is or where that frustration comes from.
Yeah, certainly. So, just one minute of background because I think it'll provide context for my comments, and that is our firm's 39 years old, and we didn't start in travel and tourism. We started in financial services. Our focus has always been on data and analytics, but when we started, there was only two direct-to-consumer marketing channels, and that was telemarketing and direct mail. And everybody hated telemarketing, right? That was the dreaded phone rings at 6 o'clock, and your dad is like, "Don't pick up that phone." And so direct mail proliferated at the early outset of RMG's beginnings. But data has always been at the center of that. And so I think what got Adam and I going a little bit back and forth is I think a very fair argument from both sides, and that is, where do you have greater value from tourism? I know he was an advocate, and I don't want to misrepresent his perspective on this. So I know he was a big advocate for saying that you clearly need to have your locals all aligned behind the message that you want to take to market. And if they don't believe in what the marketing is saying, then how is someone else going to believe in that? And my argument is, I think that's certainly a fair statement, and I agree with it. Looked at it from a different angle a little bit to say, we got into the tourism space because of a serendipitous opportunity. I had to speak at a conference, and I had the director of research from the state of Arkansas come up to me afterward and say, "No one ever talks about data. No one ever talks about ROI." And so, for us, being rooted in financial services and always looking for either a return on investment or a return on ad spend, while I think having your locals align behind your philosophical approach to marketing and validating what you're promoting. To us, it's about at the end of the day, if you can't validate and justify the success that your organization is having, then that puts your funding at risk. And we've seen that from state to state over the last several years. I think if anything, unfortunately, it's a trend that's growing. It's not a trend that's going away. And that is, in the past, no legislator ever wanted to stand up and say, I'm in favor of cutting our advertising budget for tourism. But now you're seeing that more and more folks emboldened to do that. And for me, I argue whether or not there is some element of, I wouldn't call it negligence, but should every CEO or DMO leadership team be thinking with more of an ROI return on ad spend philosophy, doesn't mean that we're excluding the locals to have a voice in what we're promoting and our evaluation of success. But to me, that's more anecdotal. And just like any Fortune 500 company, if I'm not making money or if my campaigns aren't working, I need to make changes. And so we're big believers in the measurement comes first. If the measurement is positive, you've got a great story to tell, and everybody can pat themselves on the back. If the story is not positive, then to something you were alluding to earlier, Stuart, continuing to do the same thing and expecting a different outcome is the definition of insanity.
So there's a lot of threads I want to pull, but before I ask some questions of you, Adam, would you say that that's a fair representation of what what your position was?
Well, I think, Jim, what may have happened is you saw one thing that I've said and maybe took that as my entire philosophy. So the first thing that I would say is I don't think there's much that you said that I actually disagree with. However, the point that maybe you found issue with originally, I could see why you maybe you feel like those two things collide. So step one is yes, I believe wholeheartedly and stand by the statement that if a destination doesn't have a coalition of local stakeholders, including residents, business stakeholders, and political stakeholders behind what they're doing, it doesn't matter what the results are because data is only as good as the story that's told with the data. And there's a lot of people that have really good data, but don't have a coalition of stakeholders around it, and their funding still gets attacked. They still have stakeholders pushing back on them. They still get a politician that decides that their platform is going to be criticizing the line item that's going to tourism and how the CEO of the tourism destination is spending it. And so I think you have to have a coalition of stakeholders in order to truly be successful as a destination leader. That being said, I don't believe that there's very many destination leaders who aren't thinking from a perspective of ROI, who don't desire to generate ROI for their community. And if the premise is that destination leaders, instead of just trying to build a coalition of locals, need to be thinking ROI, I don't think that's a new revelation. I don't think it's different than what destination leaders are doing. I think they're trying their very best to generate an ROI. I think the rub may be that what you view as a definitive and clear view of ROI might not be as definitive and clear to everyone else in the industry, and that may be where a little bit of the rub is.
So Jim, talk to me a little bit about from an ROI perspective, when you're talking about measuring ROI, where are you attacking that from in terms of, are you looking at it at a holistic 30,000 foot view, like the overall operations and the return, or are you looking at it at a campaign level? And when you're talking about ROI, what kind of KPIs are you specifically referring to, and where perhaps are there opportunities for the DMOs to do better?
I went to one of the state governors' conferences, and I won't name the state, but the state starts with an A, and we'll leave it at that. The chief operating officer for the state tourism agency introduced the ad agency to get up and give the metrics to determine the results, the ROI. And so a significant amount of time was spent on, we noticed year over year, our website visitation was up 23%. We got 37% more likes than we did the year before. And there was a round of applause afterwards, and the agency did a spectacular job and they built our awareness. To me, Stuart, that's not ROI. That's saying that your awareness has grown. The challenge I think that most DMOs face is the inability to understand if you're spending a dollar on attracting Jim Herenchar or $100 on attracting Jim Herenchar, How do you know if Jim Hrenchar ever comes? And if you don't know that, and you're simply looking at a year-over-year increase in visitation and saying that all of the ad awareness that we built led to that, I suppose you have a positive ROI. But to me, I think leadership needs to dig more deeply. You need to understand if we were trying to market to African American women and families with kids making over $100,000, did we attract that segment? If we did not, and that was where the majority of our focus and our ad spend was, then we need to have metrics that allow us to evaluate whether or not we were successful in attracting that segment. It's not about building, in my mind, you asked the question, it's not about building overall awareness and then saying we were up year over year. And so thank goodness our ad agency was successful in getting us there. More likes and more page views to me is not success. So I think it's looking at it. I hope I'm answering your question appropriately. To me, it's yes, it's holistically, but clearly there have to be a defined set of metrics about what percentage are we attracting or are we targeting for leisure travel? What percentage do we want for groups and conventions? Within that, what are the segments that we want to identify? And how are we doing to promote those segments, whether those are based off ethnicity or color or personal interests, right? How are we attracting those segments? And I think that my experience, and I'm painting with a very broad brush here. So, Adam, I'll state that up front. A lot of the CEOs and CMOs that we talk to on a regular basis aren't looking at it at quite that level of granularity. And it is more about building an awareness. And we're defining success about seeing rising metrics, not about looking at it more granularly to understand. Of those segments or sub-segments that we're trying to attract. For example, do we know that St. Louis is a target market and the money that we're putting into St. Louis is driving not just clicks, but actual visitations? Are we getting data that's being shared either through a Mastar report or from our lodging partners that we can then evaluate the actual heads in beds? And can we map a customer journey to understand based on the number of visits of somebody on our website, all the way through to actually feet on the street? So that's Stuart in my mind, where yes, it starts at a 30,000 foot level, but it also drills down to that 1,000 foot level. And my expectation, as I would of a corporate leadership of any entity, public or private, is to understand the metrics behind all of those aspects.
Yeah, Adam, any response to that?
I still am not entirely sure I agree with the premise that CEOs aren't trying to gather that correlating data that you're talking about, right? Where getting the granularity that you're saying, if we're targeting this specific segment, did we increase visitation in this specific segment? I think I would argue that most CEOs are trying to generate that level of granularity. I think the problem is there is a lot of conflicting data and resources out there. So, for example, a lot of destinations are using a Zardico or a Datafy or a Symphony or the other data products that are out there, and they get conflicting data. In fact, Stuart and I have talked a lot about the fact that with some of these tools, if you attribute everything that some of these data tools are providing, you're getting like 170% attribution by if you add up all the different channels. And it's like, wait a second, there's no way that's accurate. So I would argue that it's not a lack of desire by destination CEOs to get the correct data. Instead, I think it's a lack of available accurate data that truly demonstrates causation of visitation. And this is where you and I actually went back and forth a little bit on my LinkedIn post, is I believe that you may be conflating correlation and causation, because causation is that the advertisement someone saw actually caused the visitation, caused the booking. That's what attribution would be. But if we're saying, well, somebody saw an ad and they showed up in the destination, that doesn't necessarily mean that the ad caused the visitation. In fact, what it could mean is somebody came to the website because they were already planning on coming to the destination. We retargeted them with an ad, or we used some other method of advertising to them because they've demonstrated interest. And now we're saying that that retargeting ad generated the or caused the trip. And That's not that to me, that's not true attribution. And the last thing that I want to get at here is when we're talking about just awareness versus consideration versus purchase, I think it's really important to note that nobody can ever transact with you unless they're aware of you. And so awareness has value. I think it has extreme value. The question is, are we looking at it on a 6-month term, a 1-year term, a 3-year term, a 5-year term, a 10-year term? And are we generating the returns over the course of that time that we need to generate? But the idea that we could just sacrifice awareness and only focus on direct response, there's no way to generate new demand without at least some effort for awareness as well. So I don't know. There's a few different points there that I have concern with. I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I'm not sure the conclusion or the solution to the problem puts, I don't end up in the same place that you do as what the solution is to the problem.
Maybe let's clarify that a little bit in terms of what is the solution. So I think we've established that there are some challenges in the industry, right? We've established that perhaps there are some folks in the industry that are trying to avoid measurement. They're trying to avoid accountability through obfuscation, right? And that's probably a fair criticism of
I
some.
think
I'd
we
say
agree that that happens for sure.
I think that's probably a minority. I think there's a larger cohort that actively want to do a better job with attribution and analytics, but struggle with it, right? There's a lot of challenges from third-party cookie limitations to lack of clicks to actually follow someone through a deliberate path and see that causation versus that correlation. And just the sample size of the folks we can track showing up in market is limited, and we don't control the transaction, right? A lot of times, so there's a lot of challenges, but there's let's for argument's sake say that there is genuinely the majority of folks have a desire to want to do a better job of understanding what's working and what's not. You know, there's not a person in the DMO world that I've ever met that if I go to and said, would your life be better if you knew what worked and what didn't work, right? There's not anyone that would say, no, I don't want to know, right? Ignorance is probably not the choice. It's the reality they're living in. So, Jim, with that premise being made that people want to do a better job understanding, what do you think are the whole, what's the solution, and why do you think we're not getting more buy-in to the solution if it exists?
Well, I'll give you two personal opinions. I think the first is something that we have seen really for a number of years. And that is the reality that some folks are more comfortable with data and analytics than others. And as a result of that, dependent upon, in some cases, where you are in your career, you decide that I can see the end of my horizon. And I know I'm going to retire in 2 to 3 years. I'm intrigued by data, but I don't know that I'm intrigued enough to really be make myself as much a steward of the industry around analytics as I should. And I'm either going to hire somebody that'll do that for me, or I'm going to retire before I have to really deal with it. And so they tend to deal with things like analytics, measurement, segmentation, personalization at an arm's length. And it's easy in that case to be able to say, my agency's got a lot of smart people. My team internally has a lot of smart people. I'm going to leave it to them to own that. And so we run into that with a surprising level of frequency. So I think that's one side of it. The person that's just has a natural either aversion or a fear of data. I think the second side is a lot of people that are intrigued by data, that are intrigued by technology and what they're hearing in terms of identity resolution or types of personalization or detailed customer segmentation that just don't have the budget. They wish they did, but they can't convince whoever their funding sources are to increase them to a level where they can afford to deploy those types of technologies or those types of tools. So I would say there's those two elements that are keeping some number of DMOs, state offices, from being as potentially embracing technology at a broader sense, ad technology to the extent that they could.
Okay, so let's assume, for argument's sake, because I think it'll be more productive, that the folks that aren't interested in pursuing this don't listen to this show, right? They're probably not investing in their career.
That's pretty fair.
And let's assume that the folks are willing to contribute the resources if they see the value, right? I think most DMOs, all DMOs have, regardless of budget, have limited resources, right? And so they have to make a thousand decisions every day on where they're going to allocate time and money, primarily the two resources they have. So to me, it's not a question of they don't want to invest in analytics. It's that they haven't been convinced that that's the place to invest the money, right? So where's the disconnect there? Why do you feel like that is? Because I've got my own opinions. Like, we invest significantly in data analytics, but we're not even 20% of where I want to get to in terms of our ability to accurately measure causation. I think we're measuring a lot of things, some vanity stuff, but also a lot of more substantial correlation-based stuff. But I don't feel confident, you know, and I'm a dude with a pretty significant technological background, having been a physicist and a computer programmer. I understand technology, I understand data, and we're well resourced. But I'd put us sort of at the tip of the spear, but I don't think we've cracked the algorithm at all yet, and I don't think we're even close to it. We're sort of working towards it, but you know, there's a lot of limitations. And so to folks like me that need convincing, where do you feel like the disconnect is? Because you seem to be pretty confident that the solution exists. It's a lack of resource or desire that to adopt it. But help me understand. Help me get over that gap.
Well, I think part of that I'd turn back to you because you're close to it, and my question back to you, and I'll answer your question, but my question back to you is, why do you feel like you haven't achieved? You're only 20% of the way there, so what's holding you back? You said there's a lot of different things, so I think there are. I think some people, number one, where they are intrigued, where there's a commitment that they want to do something, are confused. That's the first thing. So Adam alluded to the sheer volume of different providers that are in the space. And if you were to say, I'm going to do due diligence and I'm going to bring in 4, 5, 10, you're going to hear a lot of the same things from some of them. You're going to hear some completely different things from others. And then you, as the ultimate decision maker, have to determine, based on what budget I have available, who do I think is going to best help me achieve my goals? And so, that is not a subtle undertaking, right? That's a dedication of a significant amount of time, getting those folks in, making sure that you feel confident in what you've heard, and making a decision. So a lot of folks, I think, shy away from doing that. What do they do as a proxy? Well, they already have an agency relationship, and that agency relationship, in many cases, has been ongoing for a number of years. And I applaud the agency for their ability to embed themselves within a lot of these DMOs and state tourism offices. And so many of them, one of my neighboring states, when I approach their CEO, the immediate answer is, well, you'll need to talk to the agency. They vet all of our new partners for us. Now, to me, I question, if you're the CEO, don't you want to know what else is out there? Because if I am the vetting agency, I'm going to pass along to you only that which is in my best interest. And if I'm fearful that someone's going to come along and say to me, oh, these guys actually may end up cutting 25% of our media spend, and that's a direct hit to our bottom line. We can't bring that's letting the fox in the hen house. So that's counterproductive to having the best intent of understanding, let's actually look at best practices of who's out there. Let's look outside of our agency relationship and talk to someone that we think comes in with a different perspective and isn't beholden to a media buying strategy or the budget that's made available to them based on what our funding has allocated.
I mean, I can tell you why it's structured that way. We do it to a certain extent, and it's not ideal, but it's sort of like the only paradigm we have because of our limitations. So we're sort of falsely incentivized to outsource subject matter expertise, right? Because it's really hard for a DMO with our funding models, especially for someone like Model Beach, where we can't use restricted dollars on employees. So we're sort of forced to use agencies, and so we lean on agencies heavily for that subject matter expertise. So Rather, and so we hire general people to oversee internally, and then we get the experts typically on the agency side. So that's really, we're forced into that paradigm because of our funding. And then because time and money are limited, and there are a lot of vendors in this industry that are very generic and very, I would say, mail it in terms of the approach. Like they don't, there's very few agencies. We're actually going to have this episode, a conversation about this very topic in an upcoming episode with Caleb Sullivan. But there's a lot of what I would consider sharks in our industry that are very numbers driven in terms of how many people they are outreached to. It's very generic. They're really not spending time educating us or getting to know us, either side of that equation. So I mean, I've lost count of the number of solicitations I get on any given day in a form that's very much just a sea of noise. There's very little in it that I can ascertain any level of confidence of the ability of that individual or their company to do stuff. So we've created this paradigm, like I said, that is, we create heuristics to simplify it, right? Like I would love nothing more to sit down and study every vendor that comes to me. Like I would really enjoy that personally, but it's just not the best utilization of my time because the signal to noise ratio is so astronomically heavy on the noise that I'd spend 99% of my time listening to garbage pitches just to find that 1%. And so I outsource it to someone who's a trusted partner, in this case, an agency, knowing that I have to establish parameters for that agency so that they're not just incentivized to protect their status quo, you know? So we also have checks and balances in that. Like we will select a certain percentage of vendors to reach out to directly. If there's something that is intriguing, we'll take the lead on it. But it's just a volume, and it's a sort of it, you could argue it's lazy, but I think it's not really lazy. It's more a necessity because of the volume and the complexity of what we do. So that's
Well,
why it's set up that way. I'm not
there's al
defending it because I don't love it. I don't think it's ideal, but that's why it exists.
there's also a piece of this that's going unsaid, Stuart, and that's that sometimes destination leaders will use their agency as the bad guy so that they can maintain a relationship while saying no very politely. And
Oh, that's fair.
I'm definitely also like there were some things that Jim said about the agency incentives, which I totally disagree with as well. Like, and by the way, I'm saying I disagree with the agency's incentives, not Jim in this scenario. I'm saying that the idea that an agency would turn down a vendor because it might hurt the revenue that comes from the media spend, I think that's absolutely a problem, and it's the reason I actually hate the traditional agency model is because if the incentive is to generate more media spend as opposed to the incentive being to generate results, I think you've got an incentives issue there, right? But I will say that the blind spot here is that the destination may be using the agency to say something they're not willing to say out loud, which you would be shocked
Sometimes.
at how often I'm asked to be the bad guy to a vendor that they don't want to
Yeah.
work with, but want to save face.
Yeah, I personally don't have that problem, as you know. I'm happy to be the
Yeah,
backup,
you're not one of them.
but I do think that that is a fair criticism. I think the smart agencies do not use their short-term revenue generation as their driving incentive, right? Because I think that's what creates that churn. And we do have a lot of turnover, client agency turnover in our industry for that reason, that maybe the incentives aren't aligned. But I think you can sort of structure it in a way, whether that's like the model that you're using, that's maybe tethered to results more than it is spend. I think just having a better rapport, a closer relationship with the decision makers at the agency versus, you know, just the folks that are doing the work. But I think
Yeah.
I mean, I think what we're getting to is that there are some unhealthy relationships between the agencies and the vendor and the destinations in our industry. But
There are.
I still don't think there's also a lot of healthy ones, right? And we have many
Yeah.
of those.
And the other thing is what you're asking the agency to do as well, when they've developed a significant multi-year plan to help a destination be successful, and everybody, including the destination, the agency, is pushing in the same direction. You're asking the agency to not only say, okay, this vendor is someone that we need to add immediately, but also the solutions they're offering are superior to the strategy that we've already developed and gotten approved with the client. And it's funny, I find myself defending the agency side of this when I run into a lot of the same issues, Jim, that you're talking about, right? Like, we've got products outside of the agency that we leverage and we work with other agencies for and things like that, and we run into the same problem. But understanding the agency model where you build a multi-year strategy with a client, vendor comes in and says, you need to take X percentage of this budget that you've already worked so hard to get approved, a strategy that you've got everyone pushing in the same direction on, and pivot to this additional product. It's also what you're asking is to essentially stick your neck out on the line as an agency and say, this is more valuable than what I already sold you. Right?
Yeah,
And I
I
agree
think
with.
that's why you have to have an experimentation budget set aside, right? You've got to have some allocated number that you can onboard new initiatives. Sorry, Jim, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I was interrupting, so I apologize. But I was going to agree with Adam and just cite an example. You know, I and maybe this is unfair. I'm gonna use this truly as an example, not a real life story. But if you decide that an influencer strategy is something that you are adamant about and you're going to dedicate, you know, we'll make it simple numbers, $1 million to that strategy. That is a hard strategy to get true ROI. Adam was talking earlier about, you know, attribution. To me, the whole influencer model is one that I think has zero attribution, because I just don't think you can, you know, under your definition, Adam, you'd never be able to come up with and defend an influencer strategy. But let's just say, for example, you know, that's been set. One of the things that I think myself and a lot of our peer agencies that are traditional data analytics firms would argue is, I'm not advocating that the agency, you know, change at all the spend that they've been allocated, or that the CEO of the state or DMO decides to allocate. For us, it's about measuring all of the channels that you're using, which are generating positive ROI and which are not. If your total budget's $1 million to spend, let's allocate it in those channels that are generating positive return, not those that are not. And so, to the extent that we can measure an influencer strategy, because the agency has said that we need to try that or test that, then let's do that. But then let's also recognize if, in fact, whatever metrics we put in place to define success are not being achieved, we don't have to add incremental budget. Let's reallocate whatever percentage of the million was allocated to test something else that could be more measurable.
Yeah. So let me sort of pick at that a little bit, because I think I want to circle back to what, us being probably 20% where I'd like to be. So in your example, you're saying we had $1 million and we've got a good media mix and we're spending it, across different channels, different campaigns, different mediums. And we want to measure all of that and sort of create a rank order of performance, right? And then maybe what you're suggesting is we'll take the lowest performing piece of the $1 million and reallocate it to the highest performing, assuming there's opportunity to grow that. I think the challenge I have with that is not all campaigns are designed to do the same thing. They're not necessarily reaching the same value of audience. They may be hitting people at different points in the life cycle of planning. Whether that's trying to drive awareness, trying to drive conversion. Like I could, in that scenario, it incentivizes me to optimize towards bottom of funnel direct action. And I can do that and I can win in the short term. And I can harvest the intent that's out there for people already going and, say, searching Myrtle Beach. I know, for example, if I run a pay-per-click ad on a keyword like Myrtle Beach hotels, I'm going to get really good ROI on paper for that, right? Those people are already primed. They already know Myrtle Beach. They're already showing an interest. They may not be coming. I can't really tell that. I'm going to spend money, and then I can measure that whether or not they booked, and ultimately I could use an arrival list or something to say whether they showed up in market. And that would perform great compared to maybe a display campaign or an activation I did in a new market where we just got direct airlift service, right? But that doesn't mean just because on paper the metrics, the numbers perform better for that pay-per-click campaign, that I shouldn't also be investing in this new flight market, because that potentially yields greater results 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now. And maybe I can't measure that today, but that doesn't mean, from my perspective, that doesn't mean I shouldn't do it. Because if I don't go and invest in this new flight market, then it's never going to have success. And I can give you examples where we've done that and it's worked. Like Chicago is a market that was not a big driver for us for a long time. And then we got several direct flights to Chicago. And over the period of about 3 or 4 years, we put significant dollars into the Chicago market at certain times a year with certain types of messaging. And gradually, eventually, it became one of our top 10 feeder markets during the spring, you know? And if I just measured only on ROI in the short term, I would never have stayed with that campaign. So I think that's where I struggle is because it's complicated, right? Not all campaigns are equal. Not all measurement is the same. Not all objectives are the same. And I haven't seen, everyone comes to me and says, I've got a silver bullet. And I just don't buy that there's a silver bullet because of the complexity of what we're trying to do.
Well, and people book maybe 1 to 2 trips per year. And that booking window is probably a few weeks, maybe a month in each booking
Well,
window, which
sometimes it's
means
days, man. Sometimes it's
sometimes it's
days.
days. Yeah, exactly. But that basically means that you've got essentially 10 months a year when somebody's not in the booking cycle for a trip. And so if all your messaging is buy now, buy now, buy now messaging, 10 months out of the year, that budget is completely wasted. And so I think there's a big difference between existing demand, which is people who are actively looking to book a trip and are already aware of your destination. But then you need to generate new demand. And those are the longer term strategies, like using influencers and creators and other top of funnel tactics that allow people to be aware of your destination. And the question is, what are you building for? Are you building for this year? Are you building for next year? Or are you building for the next 10, 15, 20 years? And if so, you have to create new demand. And if you limit everything to just capturing the existing demand for your destination, you're going to leave the destination at a disadvantage in the long term.
Yeah, no, I agree. Jim, you have a response to that?
So I'll just ask a question because it's informational for me. And I agree with you 100%, Adam, but I'm going to ask the question anyway because I'm curious to get your answer. So if we were to say we're going to put $100,000 of our million in an influencer, how do you measure the success of that $100,000 then?
So I'll give you a couple of different things. Number one is I'm not convinced that there's an alternative that's more measurable. And so what I would say with your question, first of all, is that it insinuates that there's an alternative that gives more clarity. Now, there might be one that gives you more data that would say that there was existing demand that we captured, or that somebody booked a trip, or that somebody who we showed an ad to showed up in market. So how would I measure that? I would measure that through the generation of travel over the next however many years based on what we're trying to accomplish as a destination. And Stuart's example is a great one, right? If we're opening up Chicago and we want Chicago to be a direct feeder market, and we're doing a combination of tactics, maybe TV, radio, influencer marketing, digital ads, and they enter our top 10 feeder markets, to me, that is ROI. That's absolutely ROI. The problem is, I don't have the direct attribution measurement of what led to each of those individual visits. I don't believe that there's something out there now where I can say that this ad caused this visit. I can say that there's two data points where somebody saw an ad and they visited, but I cannot attribute causation to that. And so I don't believe that there's an alternative that's more measurable than what we're talking about with influencer marketing in the scenario that you just described.
Yeah, so
So if
I come at it from a slight different perspective. So I look at things as we have to make some first principle assumptions in everything we do, right? Some of those assumptions are advertising works, right? To some degree, like with regards, you could argue to what degree it works, but if someone is exposed to messaging, positive messaging about your destination, they're more likely to visit, right? So advertising is better than not advertising. I think that's a first principle concept everyone can get around. I think there are other established phenomenons in advertising, such as frequency. The more frequent someone sees an ad up until a point of diminishing return, the more likely they are to see us, or to visit us. Another would be the diversification of the media mix. Like if we're showing them different messaging or similar messaging across different channels at different times, that's better than being one-dimensional. So, which is why we don't put all of our money into Google, right? So I think we have to make some assumptions. One of those assumptions I would make is that word of mouth is always going to be one of the most powerful forms of persuasion, right? And so we throughout history, throughout every channel, we would assume that when a trusted source informs us of something, it's more likely to influence our behavior than if a non-trusted source does that, right? And so I think with that premise, I think as a former CMO, as a president now of a DMO, I can go into something like content creators or influencers and with the assumption that if I select the right creator and they have the right audience, that that creator has an influence over that audience and that I can leverage that to my benefit. Now, with that premise, I'm not necessarily now as worried about, am I comparing influencer marketing to pay-per-click marketing to display ad marketing? What I'm trying to do is, how can I make influencer marketing or content creator marketing the most effective it can be for me? And so I would define and design metrics that matter. And some of those would be vanity metrics, right? So I can compare apples to apples, no question. Like, how much reach am I getting? How many actions do these people take? And what is the sentiment of those actions? But I'd also try to get some really tangible metrics. And that might be, hey, I'm going to set up a tracking code for bookings. And the goal, the main driving KPI for this campaign with this influencer A and influencer B is actually revenue booked through a booking engine or through partners or through tracking or something like that. So I'm always going to say, okay, I'm going to compare apples to apples with a specific type of medium or channel or message, but then I'm also going to see how far down the value chain can I get for this specific medium. For something like influencer marketing, I think that's easy, right? I think where it gets harder is something like display advertising, where a lot of times you've got billboard effect going on and you've got awareness being built, but not necessarily a direct tracking, right? With the influencer, I can give them a tracking code. I can give them a tagged link. I can do things that are direct calls to action that I can measure and compare. So I that's how I would approach it, slightly different than Adam.
Well, I think that's a great insight, and so I appreciate your being so transparent and coming from your perspective. The only thing I'll add for both of you, and back to Adam's point, is with ad technology today, we have the ability to do a one-to-one definition of a click on an ad. So I can tell you that it was Jim Herenchar who clicked on the digital Rob Report ad that we had, and so now there is no question mark there. We have the ability in the industry across a variety of different providers to identify between 40 to 60% of your website visitors by name and how they got there and what pages they viewed and how many times they come and how long they stay. And then if you add geoframing to that, we can also say Jim Herenchar clicked on the Garden and Gut ad that he was exposed to, or the banner ad, or the Instagram post, and then he showed up 92 days later with feet on the street.
Yeah, but where I have issues with that is it goes back to Adam's over attribution comment earlier, right? So there are certainly things we can measure and track, right? And clicks are one of those. But if I'm running, let's go back to the Chicago sort of example. If Jim was in Chicago and I'm running multiple campaigns in Chicago, I'm running some print media, some billboards, some TV, some digital, some influencer stuff, then there's a lot of things that are influencing your behavior that ultimately maybe led to a booking and a visit to Myrtle Beach that I don't have visibility into which ones of those actually move the needle, right? Because you may have seen a TV ad. Maybe I know that through CTV. Maybe I know that ad ran in your household, maybe, but that's a limited population. Maybe I know that you live in the neighborhood where the billboard's running, but there's no direct causation tracking. Maybe you saw my digital ad, but you didn't click on it, but it influenced you. But then all of a sudden, oh, you clicked on this email or you responded to this direct mail piece, something that is trackable. And then every system I've ever seen now gives 100% attribution to that last click, whatever it was, or to that one thing we can track. And there's so many intangible things that probably influenced the ultimate decision that currently, to my knowledge, aren't measurable, that we just sort of pretend didn't exist. And it's going to get us into sort of a false sense of performance for low funnel
Well,
tactics, and then we're going to shift our budget in a way that maybe performs well in the short term, but I got to believe in the long term that's going to bite us in the butt.
and even worse, a major portion of your budget would start to go toward people who have already planned a trip to your destination because they're showing all those intent indicators, when in reality, you're not affecting the trip. You're actually wasting money on someone who's already booked the trip or is already planning the trip. And that's where I get real concerned with only focusing on measurable direct response activities, is you can overcorrect, and then you're in a situation where you're not creating new or long-term demand.
Yeah, I'll give you a specific example of that, Adam. And so in a previous regime in Myrtle Beach, they spent significant dollars on Myrtle Beach related keywords on Google pay-per-click, right? On Google Ads. And we shifted away from that. And I got a little heat from it because on paper, that stuff performs really well because that person's already primed to come to Myrtle Beach. They're already searching for Myrtle Beach. They're showing an intent to travel. There's a good chance they're going to come to Myrtle Beach. So if I put a little bit of money in front of them, it's a low CPC, it's a high conversion rate, and I can pat myself on the back with measurable arrivals in town, real bookings, tangible metrics that are considered quote unquote true ROI, not the vanity metric stuff. But we made the decision philosophically, to your point, to say, we're not going to spend money on that. We're going to let our members harvest the intent that exists. Our job is to build incrementality. And so if we can long-term build iterative incrementality, then overall our market's going to perform better. So we shifted some of our pay-per-click budget away from branded keywords to maybe South Carolina keywords, maybe beach keywords, maybe family-friendly destination keywords. The ROI for those is significantly lower on paper than the Myrtle Beach branded keywords, but it's the right strategy for us if our goal is to build incrementality. So
I can't
I just
disagree. I think you're making a very valuable point. And I think that, my business partner always used to say, you can't choose what you don't know exists. And that is probably at least 50% of the hurdle that a lot of destinations have to overcome. I just know that, I go back to the old John Wanamaker. I know 50% of my advertising is wasted and I don't know which half it is. Well, we've got a lot of tools out there that can allow you a greater visibility into understanding that. Is it the be all and the end all? No, I don't think it is. But I do think, back to our initial premise, I do think there is an industry that's still struggling to understand what all is out there and how they can better measure. I don't think there's, anybody that is clearly set out to be a poor steward of the funding that they're being given, whether that's from, local resources or state legislators or whatever the case might be. I just challenge in a broad base what the level of interest is and the willingness to embrace it. And it doesn't mean that it's for everybody. But I think that for us that are focused on below the line advertising and using attribution as a critical metric, there are some things that, folks have either chosen not to embrace, turn their back on, or just don't have an interest in.
And I think it's a complex problem where I think, hopefully this conversation can lead us today is I think there's probably movement that needs to happen on both sides of the fence here in terms of the vendor side and the DMO side. I think DMOs certainly there's opportunity for us to be a little more creative and think a little bit differently about how do we measure things as effectively as we can given current technology. And knowing that technology is evolving quickly and something like AI makes what used to be hard to comprehend performance-wise, it sort of simplifies that. One of my good friends, Ed St. Ange, says that AI makes big data small. And I think that's right in terms of we can take massive sets of maybe ad creative or performance data in quickly in real time optimize towards it, right? I think that's fair. But I think there probably needs to be more conversation in the DMO side around how can we do better? Because right now I think there's a lot of people that are sort of burying their head in the sand and saying, this is hard, this is complicated, and I'm going to sort of continue to pedal along at the speed I'm going, but I'm not really going to put more effort into it. So I think from the DMO perspective, there's opportunity. But I also think from the vendor perspective, we got to do a couple of things. One is we got to quit saying we have magic bullets. Like, I think anyone that comes to me and says we can deliver the promised land and we can be all things, it just breeds distrust from the get-go. And I would love to see people more honestly approach and say, hey, here are some challenges that we know you're facing, and here's one or two things we can do to move the needle in the right direction. And let's have a conversation about it. So I think less puffery on the vendor side would be helpful. But I also wish, and I don't know if it's the vendors coming together or if it's major organizations like a DI, should come together and let's sort of agree on some frameworks, and let's agree on some attribution models that maybe we can all rally behind. And I know some folks have done things in that area in terms of organizational measurement and things like that. But I would love to see us get more granular on the marketing side. I know there was a group, I think it was led by Miles' partnership a few years ago, trying to establish a metric for the value of video views. You know, those kind of things are helpful, you know, even if they're not perfect, even if they don't solve all of the problem. It's better to have that than not have it, right? And so I'd love to see the vendors or the organizations to come together to try to help us all move forward together as an industry. So,
Yep,
Jim, we're
makes
running low
sense.
on time. Is there
Sure.
any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with? Or if you had a magic wand and a wish to leave the audience with, what would it be?
Well, I'll share this story, which I think is kind of a bit of a poster child of a great relationship we had, which was with a very small DMO that was in Central Florida. We had an opportunity to look at a lot of their visitation data, their advertising spend and budget allocation, and based on some data that was available from their lodging partners and from surveys, intercept surveys, and from the work that we had done on predictive analytics, one of the things that we identified was a breakdown of all the different segments of who their visitors were. And one of the things I was asked by the CEO, will you present this to our board? I think they'll find it very interesting. And we did. And we recognized that one of the segments that was underrepresented, which was a surprise to the board, was 18 to 24-year-olds. And they said, you know, we've got a lot of assets here. Why are this segment of our population not spending more time in our area? And so they banded together, met with the agency, took our data, came back and said, we have this unique opportunity to create something called a cool craft trail. And it was 18 different destinations that were made up of craft brew manufacturers, craft tea manufacturers, antique dealers, boutiques, ice cream shops, all these things that stretched basically from the northern terminus to the southern terminus of the destination, and created a tremendous asset that they then marketed aggressively in concert with their ad agency, and generated an overwhelming awareness using a variety of different channels. So I think when you bring people together, you know, we were kind of the genesis of saying, let's take a look at who your visitors are. Let's look at underrepresented segments. Let's bring the agency partner to the table. Let's allow them to craft some inspiring creative treatments. Let's bring in a media partner to deploy against this segment of the population in key feeder markets. And the result at the end was a home run for all partners. And so those are the relationships we love to have. And I know there's probably more of those than not. It's easy for us as vendors, as DMOs, as partners in the industry to all look and identify, you know, where's the squeaky wheel. But in reality, it's working more than it's not working. I'm glad we had the opportunity to have the conversation today and just point out that we love to be able to partner in fashions like this with all of those that have a vested interest in a positive outcome.
Yeah, that's great. That radical collaboration, I think, is the right approach, right? No one entity has the silver bullet, but bringing together all of your stakeholders to the table to solve a problem or to identify an objective that you can all work towards. I think that's certainly a good positive message that everyone can take. Jim, if they want to find you, reach out to you, learn more about your organization, how can they do that?
Yeah, our best bet is our website, www.rmg, as in Robert Mary George, rmg-usa.com.
Great. Thank you, Jim. We really appreciate the conversation today. We'd love to
Yeah.
have you back at another time. I feel like we could have gone another hour with this conversation. Adam, any final thoughts and where can I find you?
No, Jim, I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate you joining us today. I think my takeaway or my advice to everybody listening is that marketing is a combination of hunting and farming, right? Hunting is getting what's there right in front of you, capturing it. And then you also need to be farming and building for the future. And a good marketing plan will be a combination of those two. And I really appreciate the conversation today, Jim. And yeah, I think it was a great conversation.
Thank you, Adam. If they want to find you, where can they do it?
You can find me on Tourism IQ, Generation 2 just launched, and also Adam at thebrandrevolt.com.
Thanks, Adam. And I think, to double click a little bit on your hunting farming analogy, you wouldn't measure success for hunting the same way you would measure success for farming, right? So for us
No.
to assume that we do that for all of our initiatives across the board, just it doesn't make sense. So I appreciate you bringing that to the forefront. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for being part of the destination. A reminder, if you're going to Esto, we're going to be doing a session there. So please come heckle Adam, make fun of him. There might be some swag. We're going to
If
be
you love
maybe.
the Stu's News jingle, I may have something for you at Esto.
Wow, that is foreshadowing for sure. Well, we appreciate you listening. Please leave a review, tell a friend. Subscribe, all that fun stuff that makes us feel really warm and fuzzy inside. And really, it's the only way I can get Adam to show up every week is when he feels warm and fuzzy about all of the fans because he's in it for the fame, not for the money,
I'm a
certainly.
diva.
So that we certainly know. If you want to reach me, stuart.butler@visitmontebeach.com. And until next time, you've been listening to Destination Discourse.
Thanks, everybody.
We got to carry on this conversation on the golf course, it sounds like.
Let's do it. I'm in.